2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 361. To Whom Shall We Go? Historical Patterns of Restoration Believers with Serious Doubts. A paper presented by D. Michael Quinn.
Which is a second edition of a 1983 biography of Elder President Clark. And Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, also in its second edition. So all of his books are in print and available in the
book room at Benchmark Books. And for years he was affiliated with Brigham Young University as a history professor there and received his PhD from Yale in 1976. And we're going to go ahead and turn the time over to Michael now for him to deliver his paper. We will have time for questions at the end of the presentation.
Also, I won't say this at the end, but after I've finished, you're welcome to come up with commentary rather than questions. That's fine. In fact, I'd almost prefer that. In religious terms, I see three distinct, though related, forms of serious doubt for a believer. The first is doubting deity to whom you feel you owe your very existence. The second is doubting a religious leader whom you have trusted perhaps with your life. The third is doubting a religious community or institution around which your life is structured. As a Mormon existentialist, I would say that these are doubts about what theologian Paul Tillich called ultimate concern. Most of my comments will relate to the second and the third. Therefore, I'll begin with examples of ultimate doubt, questioning the existence or goodness of deity. For me, the most powerful example of ultimate doubt among the Hebrew patriarchs is not stated in the Holy Bible. However, aside from medieval mystery plays, you can find it in that most profound expression of secular scripture, the Hollywood movie. John Huston's 1966 film, The Bible, In the Beginning, presents a scene which I am sure occurred when the voice of God commanded Abraham to kill his teenage son Isaac as a ritual sacrifice to Yahweh. In shock and anguish, the Hollywood Abraham cries out that this would make him no better than the Canaanites who sacrificed their children to the false god Molech. And he asks, "Are you really the Lord my God?" The Hollywood voice of God answers, "Thou knowest." And indeed, despite the temporary doubt Abraham experienced at the command to sacrifice his son, the venerable patriarch did know. Then, as Abraham lifts the sacrificial life to kill his son, the Hollywood Isaac asks his father, "Is there nothing he can ask of you that you will not do?" Abraham answers simply, "No, nothing." I think John Huston's version is better than the Bible's silence about the father-son reactions to this event, which, by the way, had a Hollywood ending, even in Scripture. But my favorite proof texts in the Hebrew Bible about existential faith and doubt come from Job. Whether your approach is form critical, like Klaus Westermann, or literary gloss, like Archibald MacLeish, or Bible as literature, like me, or fundamentalist, like Jerry Falwell, the book of Job is subversive scripture. It subverts the idea that God protects those who trust him, that prosperity is an index of goodness, that there is value in suffering, that traditional religion can give comfort in tragedy, and that God conforms to human expectations of justice, mercy, and rationality. My favorite line is the testimony of Job, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him," unquote, which has been repeated by hundreds of millions of pagans, Jews, Christians, Muslims, and dissenters who have been killed for their particular faiths. The Bible's ultimate assessments about Job were that he suffered because of his steadfast faith, that he was justified in being bitter about his suffering, that he remained righteous while daring to question God, that he didn't know enough about the cosmos to understand the answer to his basic question of why, and so God didn't give him an explanation. I began the title of this presentation with a New Testament passage which serves as a bridge between the first and second types of doubt. The Gospel of John describes Jesus teaching a large number of his followers something he knew they could not understand. that they had to eat his flesh and drink his blood in order to obtain eternal life. Quote, many of his disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a hard saying. Who can hear it? The result, quote, from that time many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. Jesus asked his 12 apostles, will you also go away? Peter answered, to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of eternal life, unquote. Some readers think that Peter knew that it was that Jesus was his only hope for salvation. But such an interpretation misses the entire chapter's meaning. None of his disciples at that time understood that salvation is through Jesus Christ. Instead, Peter affirmed that the reason the apostles weren't leaving was, thou hast the words of eternal life. In other words, because Jesus was inspired to speak God's words. The apostles didn't know then that Jesus is eternal life. Peter continued to follow his master on this occasion because he regarded Jesus as an inspired man, even if he didn't understand everything this prophet taught. The disciples who walked no more with him had not lost their faith in God, nor in the future Messiah, but they doubted that Palestine's Jesus of Nazareth was God's spokesman, as they had once thought. And so as we reflect on the history of those who have believed in America's Joseph of Palmyra, part of that experience involves believers in this 19th century restored gospel who confronted doubt. And I must state a fundamental bias here. Just as I regard most people who profess religious belief as basically good and honest human beings, I regard most religious doubters as basically good and honest people. This is not to deny that some religious leaders are frauds, nor to ignore the fact that both those who profess belief and those who announce disbelief can be self-serving. But I accept at face value the claim of a person who says that he or she was once an ardent believer who has confronted gnawing doubts, sometimes too great for the good person to maintain former beliefs in a religious leader or organization or community. I also accept the claim of ardent believers who say they have never had serious doubts. But when struggling with doubts sufficient to contemplate abandoning their faith, other believers consider doubt's next step. To whom shall we go? A relatively small percentage of restoration doubters go to the media. But this minority of formerly ardent believers has throughout time given some very important details and insights into the Mormon experience. The earliest example was Ezra Booth's series of letters, which the Ohio Star began publishing in October 1831. The Internet now gives 21st century readers instant and worldwide access to the electronic publication of such narratives by former believers in various forms of the Mormon Restoration Movement. I'll delay discussion of an important question. Have these publishing disbelievers ever been representative of the silent majority of restoration believers who have doubted their former faith or who have, in fact, abandoned it? Aside from published narratives, there are privately created accounts of disbelief, letters, diaries, autobiographies, and in very recent times, electronically recorded narratives by former believers. Rarer still are the statements and explanations of former disbelief that have ended up in transcripts of testimony at court proceedings, civil and criminal. Over the years of examining these various sources, I have noticed patterns of doubt among restoration believers from the 1830s to the present. Some regard disbelief as a passive experience, which just happened to them, while others affirm that they actively abandoned a faith that they actively discovered to be false. While some doubting disbelievers cite a single matter as crucial, others refer to a gradual accumulation of spiritual discomforts which smother the fire of faith. Some can point to a particular year, month, day, or even moment when faith crumbled, while others are surprised when they discover that they no longer believe, and they cannot give any chronology for this remarkable change. Aside from those diversities, some disbelieve particular claims of the faith, while retaining belief in much of it. Others are chronological disbelievers who affirm the old-time religion but reject its modern leaders or doctrines or practices. Still others, who eventually reject all faith claims of the Mormon Restoration, are embarrassed that they believed at any time any part of it. With the exception of transparent manipulators like John C. Bennett in his 1842 History of the Saints, sadness is a common denominator in all accounts I have encountered by former believers in Mormonism or one of its prophets. They have lost a confidence, enthusiasm, trust, happiness, and sense of belonging that at one time seemed the center of their lives. Anger is the next most common emotion expressed by former believers, some of whom try to portray anger as the only emotional response they feel toward their former faith and its leaders. Linked with their active emotion of anger is the passive feeling of betrayal often expressed by disbelievers who say they were deceived, victimized by Mormon leaders or missionaries or doctrines or by the community itself. I think the best expression of this was published by British convert Fanny Stenhouse. Quote, "As the truth became clearer to my mind, I thought I should lose my senses. The very foundations of my faith were shaken. For 10 years, the Mormon prophets and apostles had been living in polygamy at home, while abroad they vehemently denied it and spoke of it as a deadly sin. This was a painful awakening to me. We had all of us been betrayed. I lost confidence in man and even began to question within myself whether I could even trust in God." Unquote. Once former believers have defined themselves as victimized by Mormonism, they regard believing Mormons as of only two types, either passive dupes or active participants in fraud. These former believers are the most likely to go to the media, to publish expose narratives, to define themselves as anti-Mormons, and to join with groups of like-minded crusaders. Whether they or not they become anti-Mormon crusaders, however, former believers who define themselves as victimized tend to maintain a dichotomous view of the particular claims of religious leaders and organizations. They are either true or false, good or evil. Such former believers then resume their quest for the one true religion, the one true church, the one true leader. If they retain belief in restoration claims but have rejected certain leaders or developments, these former believers then seek the only true version of Mormonism. If they have rejected its essential claims, these former believers seek the only true religion in another fellowship, perhaps returning to the one they abandoned for the Latter-day Restoration. More complex are doubting believers who see Mormonism as mortally flawed rather than fraudulent. Having once regarded the Restoration as a pristine religion, the only true one on earth, these faithful doubters have reluctantly concluded that such expectations are impossible. They acknowledge themselves as part of the problem. Rather than victims of false prophets and a fraudulent religion, these formerly ardent believers see themselves as participants in Latter-day hopefulness and perhaps as accomplices in self-deception. They are the least likely to feel anger toward their religious leaders, faith, church, or community. Such people avoid the label and crusades of anti-Mormons. They are also the least likely to join other churches. They may even maintain association with the Restoration Movement because they regard it as no more true and no more false than in any other religious fellowship. This was the reconciliation expressed in 1977 by Paul M. Edwards, a direct descendant of Joseph Smith, if I am not misreading his text, nor misinterpreting the significance of the Restoration historians I witnessed sobbing as my friend Paul said these words. Quote, "The theological assumptions are fair targets for analysis, and the church is a shell waiting to be opened in search of a pearl. If the shell turns out to be empty and nothing other than a shell, remember it has drawn us together at this hour. It has given us a community and the roots to be the growing things we wish to be." Unquote. Returning to the common denominator of sadness among restoration doubters, the emotional pain for some is almost too great to speak of. Daily diarists stop recording their thoughts, or end diaries altogether, only to acknowledge months or years later that they were consumed with doubts about Mormonism as a faith, the church as an institution, or its leaders as God's representatives. However, many resolve this anguish by doubting their doubts. Instead of being victimized by Latter-day prophets and missionaries, they see themselves as victimized by their personal weaknesses, or by those with worldly knowledge, or by Satan, or by his wicked servants, the anti-Mormons and apostates. There is an expression of this in the autobiography of a man's feeling during the last months of 1842. Quote, "During my illness, I became very much embittered in my feelings against the heads of the church, in consequence of hearing the reports that were in circulation, together with some outward appearances, and not hearing anything in favor of the truth until sometime in the latter part of the winter, when I partly recovered my health, I began to reflect upon the situation I was in, when I discovered myself lost, as it were. I knew not what to do or where to go. Having proved the different sects with whom I was acquainted and found they were not on gospel ground, Mormonism, too, I thought, had failed. And what to do, I knew not. I began to ask the Lord what his will was, and I was directed immediately back to the dispensation of the gospel which I had forsaken." Unquote. Cyprian Marsh did not record this as a cautionary tale, nor as a public testimony for or against faith, but as a private narrative of his own religious journey. I'll add here that I've been surprised by the criticism that my 1998 Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview allegedly made, quote, "direct attacks on Mormons," unquote, when it stated that the death of a young person can require redefinition of faith assumptions about promises in LDS priesthood administrations for the sick, or and of promises for long life in patriarchal blessings. One critic said that the book's statement, quote, "is unfair because every Mormon knows that these things are promised on the condition that the person remain righteous," unquote. When I read this confident assessment, I wondered if my critic had ever read the book of Job, or experienced the death of a beloved young person. Joseph, the founding Mormon prophet, said, quote, "It has been hard for me to live on earth and see these young men upon whom we have leaned for support and comfort taken from us in the midst of their youth. Yes, it has been hard to be reconciled to these things," unquote. Yet he had seen God face to face and had peered into the afterlife's kingdoms of glory. When I was 16, my bishop's daughter of the same age died from hepatitis. This good man and faithful saint was so devastated by her death that he asked to be released as bishop. During the funeral sermon, her grandfather, Apostle LeGrand Richards, looked at the sobbing bishop on the front row and said, "This tragic death is no reason to doubt God or deny the gospel," unquote. Apostle Richards then told the congregation how his own faith had been shaken decades earlier when his son drowned at the beach while Elder Richards was serving as mission president in Los Angeles. This occurred a short time before his son was to begin serving a mission for the LDS Church. Elder Richards found it incomprehensible at that time that his righteously living son was now dead, in view of the promises in his patriarchal blessing. It was only through the reinterpretation of his dead son's patriarchal blessing by a younger brother that LeGrand Richards said he finally felt comfort. A year after his granddaughter's funeral, which I attended, the apostle published his own experience of doubt and restructured faith in the book just to illustrate. In 1888, General Authority Abraham H. Cannon collapsed in uncomprehending grief when his two-year-old daughter died after he and his father, First Presidency Counselor George Q. Cannon, had promised her a full recovery in LDS blessings of healing. In 1896, Apostle Heber J. Grant was severely tested by the death of his seven-year-old namesake. He could not understand the unfulfilled promises of healing in priesthood administrations to his son. Moreover, Elder Grant could not reconcile the death of his last surviving son with his own patriarchal blessings to have sons to carry on his name. When he was 11 years old, James E. Talmage accidentally blinded his younger brother Albert with a pitchfork. While writing the first draft of the Articles of Faith at age 31, James asked members of the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve to administer to his brother. They inquired if he had the faith to be healed after 20 years of blindness. Albert said yes. In the priesthood ordinance of healing, they promised him a complete restoration of his sight. James recorded his equally unconditional expectation for the fulfillment of this apostolic blessing. Days passed, then weeks, then months, and Albert remained blind. Years passed, and Albert received equally emphatic promises of restored sight from other apostles and prophets. He remained blind the rest of his life. The either brother experienced religious doubts as a consequence. The diaries of James E. Talmage do not say so specifically, but they do indicate his own bewilderment and ultimate resignation about the non-fulfillment of priesthood blessings given and received in absolute faith. The existence of evil and evildoers is understood by Mormons in terms of distinctive LDS theology about Satan and free agency. However, the frequent lack of divine intervention in human suffering and death makes theodicy as much of a problem for LDS leaders and rank-and-file Mormons as it is for anyone else who believes in a loving God. For the LDS faithful, it can be a severe test of faith, even a time of aching doubt, when confronted with birth defects in innocent babes, unfulfilled prayers for healing, and the death of the young. Contrary to Job's comforters and the critic I quoted, these outcomes do not depend on the righteousness of those who suffer and die. In the above cases, prominent Mormon leaders experienced spiritual turmoil and apparent doubt, yet they maintained faith and continued serving the LDS Church. Without describing how they fit these personal tragedies into their worldview, or whether they needed to restructure their own faith, Cannon and Talmage became members of the Quorum and the 12 Apostles, and Grant became LDS President. My former bishop later served as mission president. Whatever causes their doubts, some Restoration believers resolve the conflict by deciding to permanently suspend disbelief and to cease questioning. The most prominent example is J. Reuben Clark, Jr., counselor to the LDS president for 28 years, who wrote the following explanation to a non-Mormon. Quote, "I came early to appreciate that I could not rationalize a religion for myself, and that to attempt to do so would destroy my faith in God. I have always rather worshipped facts, and while I thought and read for a while, many of the incidents of life, experiences, and circumstances which led, unaided by the spirit of faith, to the position of the atheist. Yet the faith of my fathers led me to abandon all that and to refrain from following it. For me, there seemed no alternative. I could only build up a doubt. If I were to attempt to rationalize about my life here and the life to come, I would be drowned in a sea of doubt." Unquote. He had once believed that in intellectual faith, quote, we may dispense with something, even rejecting as unfit, unquote, any LDS doctrine that could not endure intellectual tests. But on the brink of dispensing with everything, Clark decided his only alternative was to stop subjecting Mormonism to rational analysis. As this First Presidency counselor looked for some way to explain his position to others, he discovered an anecdote about Abraham Lincoln. Despite his reputed atheism, the Civil War president justified reading the Bible with the comment, quote, "I have learned to read the Bible, I believe all I can, and take the rest on faith," unquote. To friends, Counselor Clark related the Lincoln story and added, quote, "Substituting in substance the words, 'are Mormon scriptures,' you will have about my situation," unquote. This is what he defined as his testimony of the restoration. As second counselor and the second highest, as both first and second counselor, and as the second highest leader of the LDS Church, he recommended this anecdote to a general conference and to individual Mormons. Having once teetered on the brink of atheism, J. Reuben Clark maintained religious faith as an act of will. And because human experience is so diverse, I must acknowledge that I have probably failed to describe and categorize the experience of some who have doubted their beliefs in Latter-day Saint restoration, and of some who have abandoned their connections to the movement. Or I have described and categorized the experience in ways these individuals would regard as inaccurate or incomplete. Nevertheless, on the basis of more than 40 years researching Mormon history, I have cataloged as best I can the characteristics of believers who find themselves doubting the Mormon restoration to which they had, before that time, devoted their lives. It has been interesting to see how my cumulative perceptions of Mormon doubters compared with scholarly analysis of believers in general who confront doubt. I did not read these academic studies and until years, sometimes decades, after beginning to note historical characteristics of Latter-day Saint belief and doubt and disbelief. I've done my best to present the above summary without the influence of these scholarly views, which both eliminate the Mormon experience and overlook dimensions I found in it. Although published in 1958, prior to my study of Restoration history, it was decades before I read the observations of Leanne Festigan. Quote, "But man's resourcefulness goes beyond simply protecting a belief. Suppose an individual believes something with his whole heart. Suppose further that he has a commitment to this disbelief, that he has taken irrevocable actions because of it. Finally, suppose that he is presented with evidence, unequivocal and undeniable evidence, that his belief is wrong. What will happen? The individual will frequently emerge not only unshaken, but even more convinced of the truth of his beliefs than ever before." Unquote. His book, When Prophecy Fails, then described why people he had studied in the past and interviewed in the present maintained this cognitive dissonance. Quote, "It may be even less painful to tolerate the dissonance than to discard the belief and admit one had been wrong." Unquote. Only recently have I met Paul W. Prusser's 1974 Between Belief and Unbelief, which amplified Festinger's observation in this way. Quote, "We have noted that the self can be divided, at least in the sense of its holding inconsistent, contrary, or compartmentalized beliefs. Such divided selves are found so regularly and with such frequency that we balk at calling them all pathological. Though we may uphold the ideals of the integrated self and integrated beliefs, realism would demand that we resign ourselves to the fact that millions of people fall short of the mark." Unquote. My only correction to that assessment is to observe that compartmentalized beliefs seem to be common in billions of otherwise rational, emotionally stable human beings currently on the planet. Having read so many accounts of Mormons who confronted doubts from various causes and with various outcomes, it was instructive for me to read John D. Barbour's 1994 analysis of autobiographical accounts about doubt and restructured faith within Christianity. Based on analysis of 35 autobiographies from ancient times to the 20th century, plus case histories published by other scholars, Barbour wrote this summary about the term he used for loss of faith. Quote, "First, deconversion involves doubt or denial of the truth of a system of beliefs. Second, deconversion is characterized by moral criticism of not only particular actions or practices, but of an entire way of life. Third, the loss of faith brings emotional upheaval, especially such painful feelings as grief, loneliness, and despair. Finally, a person's deconversion is usually marked by the rejection of the community to which he or she belonged. Deconversion encompasses then intellectual doubt, moral criticism, emotional suffering, and disaffiliation from a community, allowing in particular cases that one element may not be present, unquote. He added that every deconversion also involves conversion to a new religious view, which can also be agnosticism or atheism. His Mormon example was late 20th century author Terry Tempest Williams. While I nodded in assent at each of the characteristics he listed, I found myself puzzled by his lack of reference to a very common characteristic in latter-day accounts of doubt and disaffection, the feeling of betrayal. This was not the guilt or misgiving Barber described in doubters who felt that they were betraying the Christian faith, or their families, or their religious community. Instead, it is the feeling that both converts and generational members of the Mormon Restoration have expressed that they have been deceived or betrayed by Mormonism itself. Was Barber overlooking this in the narratives of traditional Christian doubt? Or was I overstating this feeling of betrayal in Restoration narratives of doubt? Or do Mormon doubters feel religiously betrayed in ways that non-Restoration doubters do not? If the last option is the case, that is uncomfortable evidence for Mormonism as a unique faith. Though not explicitly, David G. Bromley provided one approach to these questions in his 1998 essay, The Politics of Religious Apostasy. Religious groups, he wrote, fall into three types of social organization. First, those which are highly allied with the other organizations of the larger society. Second, those which have moderate levels of alignment with the larger society, as well as moderate levels of tension or contest. Third, those which have few alignments with the larger society and its organizations, and are therefore in constant tension or conflict with it. This third group is actually subversive of larger society, or is perceived to be. Confronting the first type, an allegiant organization or religion, may be painful for believers, but is allowed by its own procedures and rules. Even the formal resignation of such obligations as priestly office or monastic life need not stigmatize the person if done according to the religion's own rules. Aside from being painful, confronting the second type, a contestant organization, religion, is perceived as disloyal even if the person is trying to improve the organization by public disclosure of its failings. However, Bromley describes that confronting or leaving the third type, a subversive organization or religion, involves brutal stigmatization by the subversive group and also involves apostate narratives directed to the larger society that the dissenter is seeking to rejoin. Quote, the archetypal account is a captivity narrative in which the apostates assert that they were innocently or naively operating in what they had every reason to believe was a normal, secure social site, were subjected to overpowering subversive techniques, endured a period of subjugation during which they experienced tribulation and humiliation, ultimately effected escape or rescue from the organization, and subsequently renounced their former loyalties and issued a public warning of the dangers of the former organization or religion as a matter of civic responsibility, unquote. Apostates from subversive organizations, religions, feel the necessity to write or speak according to the model of an Indian captivity narrative in order to be readmitted as non-stigmatized members of the larger society. In commenting on Barber's thesis, Mormon sociologist Armand L. Moss noted, quote, the Mormon Church, which possessed all the classic characteristics of a subversive organization throughout the 19th century, then began to accommodate to the larger society, until by late in the 20th century, the Mormons, like the Catholics, would thus probably fall on the Bromley continuum somewhere between allegiant and contestant, perhaps closer to the latter, unquote. Therefore, apostates, rather than mere defectors, were the most common persons to exit Mormonism in the 19th century with the attendant apostate narratives. While defectors were the most common by the mid-20th century who simply left. There have been few statistical studies of the characteristics reported by disaffected believers in the Restoration, and the first in the 1980s was consistent with Moss's assessment. Based on questionnaires submitted by a sample of 1,874 LDS Church members over the age 18, all living in Utah, three sociologists found that 14% of these Utahns became permanently disengaged from the church headquartered at Salt Lake City. Interviews with a small sample of these former Mormons show that about 1% joined some other form of the movement. 18% converted to Roman Catholicism. 42% became Protestants, generally born-again Christians. And 39% had no religious preference. Of the main group of 1,874 Mormons, another 31% were temporarily disengaged for a period of years or decades. Some still identified themselves as Mormon while non-participating. Of the disengaged, 55% of the total, counting both temporary and permanent, only 23% reported leaving the church because of, quote, problems with specific doctrines and teachings, unquote, while 42% left because, quote, their lifestyle was no longer compatible with participation in the church, unquote, and still others had interpersonal problems which caused their non-participation. Therefore, the authors concluded that, at least in the 1980s, quote, doctrinal issues are not central to the disaffiliation process for Mormons, unquote. Although the authors acknowledged that their study did not explore disaffection resulting from the loss of one's personal faith, they failed to emphasize a strong bias in their sampling, which artificially depressed the statistics of former Mormons and of disengagement. Their sample did not include those who were no longer on the records of the LDS Church due to excommunication or voluntary withdrawal of membership. Perhaps more significant, because the sociological study was based on membership lists of Mormons in local congregations in Utah, its 1980s sample did not include the lost members file in the membership department at LDS headquarters. This contains the individual record of membership for Latter-day Saints whose current addresses are unknown to any local LDS leaders and who have therefore whose records have therefore been sent to the headquarters of the church for centralized inventory, records management, and location searches. These people apparently do not want to be located because they want no affiliation with Mormonism. There are hundreds of thousands of lost members in the files at LDS headquarters in Utah. How significant are such statistics for the institutional churches of the Mormon Restoration? LDS headquarters collapsed into apostasy in 1837, and one-third of its leadership abandoned the church within a year. I have previously described Mormonism as a movement in crisis after the 1844 martyrdom, when even a scholarly advocate of Brigham Young acknowledged that half of the LDS membership, as of 1844, refused to follow Young to Utah. Entire church organizations of Restoration believers collapsed during subsequent decades. According to the statistically conservative findings of the 1980s study, 55% of Utah's Mormon population was non-participating a century after Young's death. Since 1984, at least one-third of the RLDS Church membership, now Community of Christ, headquartered in Independence, Missouri, has ceased membership due to their church's ordination of women. And I've heard estimates that one-half of the reorganized membership as of 1960 left the church in recent decades due to conservative rejection of various liberalizing developments. For more than 170 years, faithful Restoration believers in spiritual crisis have asked themselves, "To whom shall we go?" Their answers have sometimes shattered families and rocked institutions. Which brings me back to the Bible, to scholarly silence about betrayal in Christian narratives of apostasy, and to the devaluation of faith crisis by Mormon scholars who comment on LDS disaffiliation and disaffection. The existential Abraham, who lives between the lines of the Hebrew Bible, but openly in a Hollywood epic, regarded as betrayal God's commandment to sacrifice his son. Job clearly regarded this betrayal. The fact that God killed his entire family and allowed him to suffer without giving him any better comfort than the platitudes of friends and religious leaders. Jesus faced his ultimate betrayal, not from Judas in Gethsemane, but on the cross as he cried out in anguish, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Yet, beyond reason, they embraced their divine betrayer in what philosopher Soren Kierkegaard would call a leap of faith. In one sense, it is odd that a sense of betrayal is absent from Barber's analysis of Christian narratives about faith change and apostasy. That sense of spiritual betrayal was central to most of the great heresies against early Catholicism, as it was to the Protestant reformers who apostatized from Holy Mother Church, and to the Protestants who apostatized from the Anglican Church, and to Puritan apostates like Anne Hutchinson and Roger Williams. However, in apostasy, betrayal is a double-edged accusation. Applied by the religion to the dissenter, or the defector, however defined, and by the dissenter to the religion. Perhaps that is why Barber did not mention it. Nevertheless, a sense of spiritual betrayal by the institution, its leaders, or its members, has been a common theme in apostasy narratives, both Christian and Mormon restorationist. More painful than doubt itself is the betrayed feeling that one has been spiritually deceived, manipulated, exploited, or abandoned. The 1980s Mormon sociologists also ignored this question when studying LDS disaffiliation. Do restoration doubters feel more betrayed than other religious doubters? That is impossible to judge. But it is possible to quantify whether a sense of betrayal appears more often in narratives by Mormon doubters. Someone else should do that analysis of comparative religion. To whom shall we go if we do not simply doubt propositions of faith, but if we feel spiritually betrayed by God, or by those humans we trusted with our eternal welfare? Like ultimate concern itself, this is an ultimate quandary. It is a religious crisis that is poorly served by sociologists who condescendingly described the disaffection and apostasy of Mormons who felt betrayed by their church and its leaders. It is a crisis experienced by Abraham, by Job, by the disciples of Jesus, by members of Holy Mother Church, by survivors of the national massacres of Spanish Muslims, French Protestants, English Catholics, Chinese Christians, Armenian Christians, European Jews, and Bosnian Muslims, by survivors of the killing fields in Cambodia and Rwanda. It is a crisis experienced by doubting believers and restoration leaders Joseph Smith, James J. Strang, Sidney Rigdon, William Smith, Lyman White, Brigham Young, Alpheus Cutler, Joseph Smith III, Granville Hedrick, Wilford Woodruff, Frederick M. Smith, Heber J. Grant, Lawrence C. Woolley, Spencer W. Kimball, Wallace B. Smith, Gordon B. Hinckley, and Warren Jeffs. I propose no answer to this question, to whom shall we go, but simply acknowledge its power in the lives of believers who confront serious doubts. I have given only a brief summary of its effects as I have observed them in past and present. If I argue for anything, it is that unshaken believers, lifelong skeptics, and self-confident academics should all stop devaluating the anguish of people they do not understand. I also say these things with no disrespect for deity, with no mockery, but as a restoration believer in the inscrutable God of Genesis, of Leviticus, of Job, of birth defects and leprosy, of Calvary and the empty tomb, of Mecca, of Black Death, of Inquisitions, of Native American genocide, of Palmyra, of Hans Mill and of Mountain Meadows, of Lourdes, of multi-million deaths in natural disasters called acts of God, of Auschwitz, of Hiroshima, of infantile paralysis, of Cambodia, of pandemic starvation, of AIDS, of Bosnia, of Rwanda, of pediatric cancers, of 9/11, who is also the God of the most recent tragedy and the most recent miracle among us. I speak with the knowledge that my own faith, hope, and love may also be betrayed.
We have a question to start off with? A comment? Is there a hand I'm not seeing? Or? Okay. Yes. Yes, you might as well, because I think we'll have time. So. Stairs are on this side. This is a little dangerous.
So my question is around something you alluded to. What would you see as the influence of the internet on the doubter?
Material that at one time was available only if you really went looking for it is now available on the internet. And for teenagers, for young adults, for people of any age, background, in any country of the world, if they plug in the term Mormon history or Mormonism, and they may be intending to read posts on the internet or excerpts from publications that reinforce their faith, but they are inevitably going to come across hundreds, perhaps thousands, of websites which are, in many cases, specifically designed to attack faith. And so the internet has made available the contrary evidence, the polemical attacks on faith to a degree that Mormons were never subjected to it before. Because all by simply doing a Google search on Mormon history or Mormonism or the LDS Church, the person wanting to scan those various websites will at least scan the opening line of every website that is designed, particularly by evangelical Christians, some of whom are former Mormons, but designed to disrupt faith. So it's a much more extensive exposure than was possible before the internet.
Sure, go the other way.
To pick up on the last question, Mike, I've thought a lot about this, and I'm very curious to know what your prediction would be. I don't expect you to be a clairvoyant, but I'd really be interested to know how long you feel this will come about, if it ever will come about, and that is how long it would take before the average member of the church, or most of the average members of the church, really start asking very tough questions of their bishop based on this huge influx of information that is now coming over the internet, and in the whole context of this great information revolution that we are experiencing. It seems to me that it's quite the rolling stone that gathers moss? It seems like it's going to gather no moss. It seems like it's really going to come to quite a head sooner rather than later. But maybe I'm just guessing.
I think there are numerous ways of responding to that. I'll give just a few ideas. I don't know that there is a definitive answer, but just some of my thoughts on this. The access to the internet is still, internationally anyway, it's a function of privilege. And in the United States, in Canada, in Europe, in industrialized countries, middle classes, upper classes have basically instant, unlimited access to the internet. This is less common among the disadvantaged in society, whether it's the disadvantaged of the industrial societies I just mentioned, or in societies throughout the world where they are not industrialized, where there is a very high percentage of the population which is just struggling to provide basic needs. So because of that, the access to this contrary information is more likely to occur in those countries of Europe, North America, and the industrialized portions of other parts of the world, such as Japan, where members of the church in those countries have pretty much easy and instant access to the internet. And therefore, the effect of this kind of anti-Mormon propaganda that is intended, I mean, people call me anti-Mormon, but my purpose has never been to disrupt someone's faith. But the internet, whether they're quoting me or they're quoting Harold B. Lee or Brigham Young, many of these sites quote items and cite items that they want to use as a club to destroy people's faith in Mormonism. And just because of the nature of the demography, those who are most likely to get it are people who constitute half or more of the membership of the church. But the other half of the membership of the church, since about half now live outside the United States and Canada, aren't going to be affected by this at all. And so there's kind of an irony that I think that it's very possible that rates of disaffection will be far higher in the industrial world among middle-class, upper-middle-class Mormons than will be true in the rest of the world among Mormons who are in countries in circumstances where they struggle and, as a result, have little access to the internet.
I think, while I agree that the internet is probably different as a medium of diffusion, there have been so many claims as new technologies come up that this is going to be the one that really gets into the consciousness of people. So I have my doubts about that. But my question actually derives from your venturing to the international arena, because if I understood you correctly, if I followed you, the changes of doubters and the kinds of seem to have is related to the kind of church and the alignments that it may have. Of course, all these hypotheses are drawn from the American context, the English-speaking context, and of course the last probably 150 years. But if they were to hold true, and, you know, going back, the diachronic effect and just it's not very testable except through the international context. If it is true that these associations exist, I keep thinking in Latin America the rate of inactivity being quite high, just as it is all over the world. But if the supposition is true, then we could probably test it out in areas where the church is younger, where the associations and the alignment may or may not be there. I mean, and we have plenty of both kinds. And therefore, if the interest is really there, I doubt very highly that that we get the more aligned that especially Mormonism is with general Christianity, then the less of an exiting of an exodus we would have anyway. So anyway, just to put that into thought. And lastly, My experience, especially in Latin America or even in West Africa, is yes, it's true that the elite do have better access and more constant access, but the internet, you see it in the slums of Bangkok. I've seen it. I see it in West Africa. In the most remote, either they're sharing one little dial-up line among 50 people. But it's there. Street kids with email addresses that I correspond to. So we have to be careful. The old notion and what went on here in the States and in the Western world doesn't necessarily hold.
I'll respond to that in two ways. One, that comment and a couple of others before have been based on my kind of one-line reference to the internet, and also have tended to work on an assumption that doubt comes because of contact with somebody else who leads you to doubt, which can be the case. But as I point out, people confront doubt for many, many reasons, and contamination by an apostate or somebody who is trying to disrupt faith is, I think, actually a minority experience for those who confront doubt. People confront doubt because of the circumstances of their own lives. That's what I've found. Their own experiences in the church, totally independent of somebody trying to attack their faith, their own experiences in their personal lives as they negotiate their faith with their experiences, usually are the causes or the sources of doubt, independent of somebody else trying to attack faith. So on the one hand, the questions about the internet I think are appropriate and applicable, but I think they apply to a very small minority of instances of personal doubt, which I think come in an independent way. You don't need to read something that will necessarily cause doubt. That can be one source of doubt, but doubt often comes, as I pointed out of existential experiences, one's own experiences in life, one's own experiences with the church, with the experiences of the community of faith can also cause doubt. And then, as I point out, doubt can also occur without anyone being able to assess why it happened. It just happened. And there have been those whose personal accounts I've read who just suddenly discovered they don't believe anymore. And it's not because of contamination nor because of tragedy. It's just that somehow they realize they don't believe anymore. So, I mean, I'm talking about a very diverse kind of experience here. I do acknowledge, in terms of the comment about the availability of the internet, I don't want to impose another kind of North American El Norte bias on the peoples of the world and their access to the internet. It's true that the internet has become independent in many cases of wealth and social circumstances, and even street people can have email addresses. But the more constant access to the internet and the ability to stay hours in front of a screen is still more common among people who have greater wealth.
For those of us in the back who are hard of hearing, could you please either repeat or expound on the last two sentences of your talk? It was very intriguing to me. So.
The last two sentences of the talk were very personal. They were personal represent statements of my own sentiments, of belief. I imagine that not all people share, or maybe very few. Maybe I'm a church or in a religion of one in this regard. But the God I believe in is not a rational God. At least he does not behave in ways that I can understand as a rational person. He is a God, and by my own experience, who has intervened in my life, who has protected me, who has healed me of polio, for one thing. I was born with a cleft palate, for another. Who has allowed me to be a good speaker, despite that. Who has allowed me to be, back in the day, not a marathon runner, but I used to run 35 miles every morning in 35 minutes. And yet I had polio. And I was administered to for both of these. And yet, this God, whom I ardently believe in, who I appeal to for intervention in my life, I cannot believe that he has intervened in my life and allowed a child to die of pediatric infantile paralysis or pediatric cancers because I'm a righteous person, and because the parents of that child who died of leukemia, or the child being old enough to pray himself or herself, that intervention in my case has any appeal to rationality or righteousness. So I believe in an inscrutable God, a God who will intervene on occasion, but totally unpredictable, who allows millions to die at Auschwitz, who allows the millions to die in all the ways I enumerated, and yet who will intervene as well. And so when I say that I say these things with the knowledge that my own hope in God, my own faith in God, and my own love for God may also be betrayed, is that I see God as a betrayer. He is my comforter. He is my Father. He betrays me as he betrayed Christ on the cross. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Because we do not understand. And I accept that because for me it is an inevitable consequence of the kind of world I observe. Maybe no one else has that kind of response to God. But when I pray, I pray to God as my Father. I cry to him in my pain. I ask for his mercy. I ask for his intervention, and I shout at him. Why? And I don't expect the answer. Because like Job, I don't understand enough.
We need to close, unfortunately. There's another session starting in just a few minutes. So we do need to leave the room, too, but perhaps Mike will be available at some point if you have questions for him or want to share your comments. Thanks for coming. You can buy a copy of this tape at the registration table.